I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to have an important conversation about health. Studies have shown that depression can increase a person's chances of having a heart attack or a stroke. Today, we'll talk about what we can do about that. My guest will be Dr. Jesse Stewart, a psychology professor at the IUPUI School of Science, Dr. Chris Callahan of the IU Center for Aging Research, and Cindy Wilson of Eskenazi Health Midtown Community Mental Health. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Twitter is WFYI, Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Now, the news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about depression and heart disease today on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, if you have a question about the links and how you can take care of yourself, please call us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are three experts. We have with us Dr. Jesse Stewart of the IUPUI School of Science, Dr. Chris Callahan, director of the IU Center for Aging Research, and Cindy Wilson of Eskenazi Midtown Community Mental Health. Welcome all of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's good to have you here. Well, I'm going to start first. Jesse, you're sort of the trigger for this program, because you've published a report, or co-authored, indicating that there might be some ways to intercede and break down this linkage between depression and heart disease and or stroke. Could you talk a little bit about what your findings were and why you started looking in the first place?
Yeah, sure. So there's been about three decades of research linking depression to cardiovascular disease, so heart disease and stroke. So depression, a patient who's depressed today is at greater risk for heart disease and stroke in the future. One of the issues, though, has been that in the past decade, there have been a number of treatment studies looking at whether or not depression treatment could lower that risk. So if you treat a depressed patient, can we bring their risk back to the level of someone who's non-depressed? And those studies have focused on treating depression after a patient has experienced a heart attack, so pretty late in the game when you consider the state of their arteries. Our idea was to treat depression, look at the effect of depression treatment earlier in what's called the natural history of cardiovascular disease, so before someone has a heart attack, but you just are at elevated risk, so with risk factors. And what was exciting about the recent report, our study, was that we found that depression treatment initiated prior to a heart attack or a stroke did lower the risk of a future heart attack or stroke. It really cut it in half. So those who received depression treatment and were depressed had half the risk of those who were depressed and received what's called usual care for depression. Now, in the small group that had cardiac disease when they got the depression treatment in our study, we didn't see that protective effect, which was consistent with prior studies too. So the take-home message was, I think we need to get in earlier in the natural history of CVD and treat depression if cardiovascular benefits are to be expected.
Chris Callahan, do we know why there is this linkage? I mean, does the research show us why being depressed does lead to to these, you know, we tend to think of it as a mental health issue rather than a physical health issue. And don't worry, Cindy, I'm going to come back to you at some point and ask if that might be part of the problem. But do we know why this occurs in the fashion that it does?
Well, the short answer is no. We don't know why. And as Dr. Stewart was pointing out, the connection's been clear and been identified for decades, if not centuries, that how you were feeling mentally and your mental health could have impact on your physical health. When people hypothesize or think about what the connection might be, it sort of rounds up the usual suspects. Things like stress is not good for your brain and it's not good for your heart, or maybe even physical things that maybe a poor diet, no exercise, not a good home environment is bad for your mood and it's also bad for your heart. So these kinds of studies keep lending weight or credibility to the connection, but we haven't really untangled exactly what the connection is.
Now, Cindy, I guess is some of the problem here that we do tend to think of this, you know, non-medical professionals, but those of us out there think that there's a dichotomy between a mental health issue and a physical health issue, a difference, and that, you know, mental health is something you ought to be able to just tough your way through. Physical health is something you go see a doctor for.
Well, there is still stigma attached to getting treatment for depression. And when people might start to have some of the symptoms of depression, they do tend to think that way. Oh, I just need to try harder. Maybe it's just, you know, I don't feel well right now. They tend to minimize it. And so they may not bring it up to their family doctor to talk about it in that element. And so they're resistant. And sometimes it's to the point where they're very, very depressed before they ever seek any treatment out for the depression.
We are talking about the connection between depression and heart disease here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Yes. The question I had for your panel there was that my mother, a senior citizen in her late 70s, had a heart attack a couple years ago, and I help care for her. She's still independent and lives her life well. But she's been on antidepressants for about 10 years. And I wondered if there's any link also with the type of antidepressant she takes. Could there be some effects that have somehow affected or can affect her heart, you know, much like someone who takes too much Advil or Tylenol could affect their liver. And I'll take my question off the air.
Great. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Bruce. I'll toss that to whoever would like it.
It's a great question, and I'm glad your mother's doing better. It sounds like she's still living on her own, which is what so many older adults want to be, to get back to living independently. The issue with the antidepressants is that the older antidepressants, the ones that we call tricyclic antidepressants or TCAs, but they're the ones that were more common before the 1980s, that's been known for some time that they were linked to heart disease, but they were more linked to heart disease in terms of rhythm disturbances. For most older adults now, the doctors would be prescribing the newer generation of antidepressants because that older generation also had impacts on thinking or cognition or your brain function. So one of the things that it would be great to talk to your mother's doctor about, especially if you accompany your mom, is to learn what type of antidepressant that she's on, and to hear if there's other things that she might do beyond the medications that might help her with her mood. Part of Dr. Stewart's work, which I'll let him comment on, is beginning to look at whether these newer antidepressants might have effects on our cardiovascular system that goes beyond the effects we know they have in the central nervous system or the brain.
Probably it'd be good also at this point to to define what we're talking about when we say depression. It's, you know, what was the standard you were using as part of the study? Because I don't think, you know, it's more than just waking up and feeling a little sad one morning.
Yeah, definitely. So typically when you hear the term depression, what's being referred to as a psychiatric disorder, major depressive disorder. And major depressive disorder is not just sad mood. It's actually a cluster of symptoms. So there are the emotional symptoms like the depressed mood and the loss of interest or pleasure. There are cognitive symptoms, sense of worthlessness and concentration problems. There are behavioral symptoms, moving slowly and speaking slowly. And then there are somatic symptoms, so sleep and appetite changes. And when you have five or more of these symptoms for a period of 2 weeks and they're causing some impairment in your functioning, that's when you would be diagnosed with major depressive disorder. That's usually what we're talking about. Our study involved patients with major depressive disorder or dysthymic disorder, which is another depressive disorder that is kind of lower severity but very chronic, so 2 or more years of having symptoms of depression.
And I should – and Cindy, I guess it would be wise to ask you this. I mean, to some degree, you've got two situations here that you could be dealing with. One is if you are experiencing these feelings yourself and these symptoms, then obviously you should probably make a call and try to get some help. But the other possibility is that you observe someone who is close to you who is experiencing these things. You now know it's not just that someone's feeling bad or struggling. They're also, based on the results of this study and the evidence, putting their life at some risk, too, by not dealing with it. What are the symptoms when you're observing somebody that you should take note of and realize, okay, maybe I need to intervene here if I care?
Well, the depressed mood and affect is definitely one symptom. Withdrawal. Things that they used to do that were pleasurable, they won't continue to engage anymore. They will lose weight or they'll gain weight. Sometimes their appetites increase or they don't eat anything. They don't necessarily want to engage in pleasurable activities, so they'll withdraw from the family. They may sleep excessively or they may not have any sleep. If the patient starts to or person starts to do things like giving their possessions away and they start to talk about feeling hopeless or worthless or they don't really have a plan, maybe they are engaging in, you know, some kind of things like school is, you know, they withdraw from school or they withdraw from other friends and family. Those would be things that family members or someone observing should keep an eye open for.
And when you see someone in that situation, suppose that person does get help, what are the first steps in terms of attempting to help someone who?
I think you would, you know, want to approach the person to see if they're willing to go and get help. We would certainly want them to come willingly. We would engage in if it's a true crisis where someone's talking about trying to kill themselves, then that's a different kind of a circumstance. You would try to direct them to a crisis center. We have a crisis intervention unit at Eskenazi Health where we would direct someone and we would have an immediate intervention to assess their state of suicidality. If it's the beginning stages of depression, we would want to try to get them to get assessed and make an appropriate call about whether it's talk therapy, psychotherapy, individual therapy, medications, talk to them about medications and helping them to get started on the right medications. And basically, don't just ignore the signs. If you see somebody who's having these symptoms, then you need to reach out to them and don't just assume it's nothing. That's something that sometimes does happen.
Well, I guess where I'm going with this is, what is the first step when you're dealing with someone who is experiencing depression? How do we break this cycle that seems to – how do you get through the depression? Dr. Stewart.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, the issue of getting someone – opening their mind to seeking treatment is key. So I think maybe presenting a rationale to them that you're concerned about them and what the changes that you're noticing. The latest – and they've been around for a while now, but care models for depression involve patient preference. So the patient – being an active player in their treatment and deciding what the most appropriate course is, whether it be antidepressants that have been shown to work or talk therapy that has been shown to work. So I think that's a good way to engage a patient in their care.
We are talking about the connections between depression and heart disease, also depression and stroke, basically depression and a lot of really bad health problems that you likely would want to avoid. If you can join the conversation, you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Jesse Stewart of the IUPUI School of Science, Dr. Chris Callahan, Director of the IU Center for Aging Research, and Cindy Wilson of Eskenazi Midtown Community Mental Health. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about depression and heart disease, the link between the two. My guests are Dr. Jesse Stewart of the IUPUI School of Science, Dr. Chris Callahan, who is the director of the IU Center for Aging Research, and Cindy Wilson with the Eskenazi Midtown Community Health Mental Health. I screwed that up. Eskenazi Midtown Community Mental Health. Again, we are talking about the linkage between depression and heart disease. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
I was sort of curious. When a pharma company like Eli Lilly or Pfizer decides to demonstrate that a new antidepressant is safe, what are the studies they must do for the regulatory bodies that they have to get approval from, and how well does that correlate with what your guests were speaking about?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Dr. Jesse Stewart.
Yeah, so with those with the drug trials for the drug development, they're typically shorter term trials. So oftentimes, the long term effects of taking antidepressants in this case aren't really known, and those are found out after approval. I would like to say that the medications, the antidepressants that are commonly used today, so the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, and the serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs, I'm not aware of any evidence showing that they have any negative effects on the heart or vascular system. And there's some slight suggestive evidence that they might be cardioprotective, perhaps by affecting the platelets. So I think there's no evidence to date that those newer drugs are harmful to the heart.
It sounds like, you know, from listening to this, a lot of the steps one would take to combat heart disease or physical health problems are also steps one would take to battle depression in the first place. Namely, you know, you try to get some exercise, you pay attention to your diet, you make sure that you get adequate rest. You know, is that, Cindy, is that an acceptable hypothesis or?
Yeah, I do think that depression is a chronic condition oftentimes. So I do think there's a lot of similarities between treating depression and other medical conditions. And, you know, a lot of times people will try that initially. You know, they'll try to increase their exercise or they'll change their diet or do those kind of things. And they still find themselves having a, you know, variance in their mood. But, yeah, there's definitely a lot of similarities between those.
Do we know what causes depression?
That's a big question.
You know, that's why we have an hour on the air.
Well, it is. It's a wonderful question. I think you're also maybe in your earlier question alluding to this notion that the more we find out about most diseases, the more we find out that the disease is much later in its course when the symptoms show up. And so the research on depression, the research on dementia, the research on diabetes, arthritis, what have you, keeps moving earlier and earlier. A lot of our work has focused on depression in older adults, but we're finding that it's what happened to you in your 20s and 30s and 40s that explains, or at least partially explains, why you arrive in older age with not only mental health problems, but with physical problems.
And are there situations in which, you know, depression is a rational response? Or maybe another way to say that is, what's the difference between depression and grief?
Well, it's a wonderful question. There, one of the things that often happens is people wonder if their particular grieving course is normal. And it's hard to say what's normal grief for one person or another. What we tend to look for, though, is, as Jesse and Cindy mentioned early, is that you've withdrawn from activities you used to enjoy. You've withdrawn from people that you used to enjoy or activities, and that these have begun to affect your health itself. So should you grieve for 3 months or for 3 years? Nobody really knows what's the normal range there, but when it begins to impact your health, you probably need help.
And does the study show that, for example, and the reason I ask the question is, in my work, I've interviewed people who have lost children or have, lost spouses that they've, been married to for 50, 60 years. And you expect, the sadness to be profound and pervasive at that point. Does that pose health risks too? Dr. Stewart.
Yes, Jesse Stewart. That's a very interesting question. Just to back up a second,
sure.
I think one thing that a few aspects that distinguish clinical depression from normal grieving or prolonged sadness are those other symptoms we discussed. So feelings of worthlessness, so a cognitive symptom, and the sleep and appetite disturbances, is the weight loss, the weight gain potentially, and then the effects on functioning, so the withdrawing from work and family and friends are really quite different. So I think it's an interesting question, and it's one that's going to require research, whether grieving
your next project
is associated with elevated cardiovascular risk. I don't think that's out there in the literature.
Well, and let me then take it in another direction, Cindy. Is it how often or how common is it for grief to veer to depression?
I think the potential is there, and I think a lot of the variables surround that are the, kind of the conditions of the loss. If it's a sudden loss, then there's no closure for the family or for the person affected by it that might have an impact on it. But I think Dr. Callahan's, we really don't know why some people respond certain ways or what impacts their ability to be resilient in the face of a loss like that. There's unresolved grief that sometimes goes back into your early 20s when you're in your 50s, and so there's a lot of that can continue to impact your health in negative ways. But that's a very large variable that I don't know that we have a good answer for. But we would certainly start to look for those signs of depression if somebody has had a loss and it's they are exhibiting symptoms of depression related to the loss. That would, I think, would be when we would want to intervene. As a family member, you would certainly want to keep an eye on that.
We are talking about the linkage between depression and heart disease, depression and stroke, depression and some really bad health problems. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@WFYI.org. Twitter is No Limits WFYI, or Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Well, in terms of where this research has gone now, how should it change the way that we've talked about how it should change the way people live their lives? I mean, I think we've agreed probably all the things that are good for your heart in the first place are things you ought to be doing also to preserve your mental health as well and to and to avoid depression or at least mitigate some of its worst effects. How is it going to change the way you practice medicine? Dr. Callahan.
There's a couple of points to be made about this particular study, and the data that the study come from were from a clinical trial that flipped a coin and people either got an intervention or they didn't get the intervention. And Dr. Stewart talked about this intervention. It was a team approach to depression care. That was the original study. And that study, for the first time, produced really unequivocal evidence that treating depression in old people can make them better. And so it sort of removes some of these negative notions that some older people and providers had, that depression just happens to you when you get older and you can't treat it. That's not true. So one of the things that we want people to know is that just because you're old, just because you've experienced a loss, doesn't mean that you are have a depression and it can't get treated. Depression can get treated. What Dr. Stewart did, though, was take those data from that study that finished in about 2004, and he followed those people for another 7 to 10 years and said, of those people that were in that team approach to care, were they more or less likely to have heart attacks? Once he takes that step where he's now observing rather than flipping the coin of which group the people take in, we call it an observational study. And so it's less powerful evidence. So right now, it isn't evidence that could change the way that doctors practice. It's a hint. And the hint is that we need to look more closely about intervening on depression, not just because people are depressed, but because it might protect them from a future heart attack. And that's where we move into the area of what Dr. Stewart uncovered was, here's a whole nother angle that we need to explore, both for treating depression and for preventing heart disease.
And the fact that you focused on this more as a problem of old age, of seniors dealing with it, raises some questions about, you know, who all, you know, presumably there are people in their 20s who get depressed. Did the study show that their increased risk of heart disease is the same? Is it something, and how long does it go on? That if you're depressed from the ages of 22 to 25, but then you deal with it, do you carry that risk all the way through your life, or is it something that's been minimized later on?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. This is the first study to show this cardioprotective effect of depression treatment. And you're correct in pointing out that we only found it in older adults because that was the sample of the study. In my opinion, I don't think there's any reason to believe that wouldn't extend down into the younger age ranges. The older adults provided a nice context for the study because they're at much higher risk for, mm-hmm. for cardiac events. Now, your other question about can you reverse the effects of depression, and for how long might someone need to be depression-free to bring their risk back down to a level of someone who is never depressed? One, it reminds me of what we think about with respect to smoking, and how long must you quit smoking for your risk to return to those levels. I think that's a fascinating question. It's a great way to conceptualize it. Those studies have not been done yet. So some of the future work that we have planned will be looking at a broader age range.
And in comparison with some of the other factors that affect heart disease, stroke, diabetes, genetics, heredity, what's the correlation there, or is there a point of comparison at all?
Yeah, so oftentimes when you think about traditional cardiovascular risk factors, you'll think about the big three or the big five, so high blood pressure, high cholesterol, smoking, obesity, and diabetes. What's been shown in those studies with depression predicting cardiovascular risk is that the magnitude of the risk is not trivial. So it's on par with those traditional risk factors. So Someone who's depressed has 1.5 to 2.5 times greater risk of heart disease than someone who's not depressed.
We've gotten a question from Facebook. A listener says, could your guests please speak about stress as a trigger for depression? Cindy, I'll throw that one your way.
Well, stress is, I think it's really how you handle the stress. We all have stress in our life. Getting out of bed in the morning is stressful. And I think a lot of times that the stresses that that are in our lives, how we choose to deal with those, do we seek additional supports? Do we try to find ways to eliminate the stress, or really the critical factors in how much stress is going to have an impact on your mental health? If you constantly have a high level of stress in your life, it certainly can make you more vulnerable to having depression. It can make you more vulnerable to having poor health in general. It'll have an impact on every angle or every aspect of your health. So I think stress is, it's really the ability to cope with the stress that seems to have the negative impact on our health overall, as opposed to just the stress itself.
What are the signs that you have too much stress? I mean, you're right. We all have to manage some stress in our life, but it presumably, just like there are appropriate amounts of ice cream you can have, you know, but, you know, a gallon a day is probably excessive. What's too much stress?
I think people start to probably exhibit some physical symptoms. They probably find themselves maybe more irritable, maybe more angry. They may not be sleeping as well at night. They may have some of the symptoms of depression, but not necessarily maybe the cluster that just Dr. Stewart talked about at the beginning with, you know, what we would need to actually diagnose a depression. But they may indeed experience some physical symptoms related to stress, frequent crying, or maybe they are just not able to handle a workload like they used to, and or they're not able to discipline their children, or it really disrupts their life. Something in their day-to-day existence may be impacted in a negative way, and that may be one of the signs that the stress level is too high for them.
We are talking about the links between depression and heart disease, depression and stroke. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I want to tack this from the other end, too. I mean, what is the likelihood that this becomes a cycle, you know, a circle that you can't break? Because I've known people who have had heart attacks, and depression is often a response to that. If that's the case, then it sounds like the depression can produce circumstances that would just lead to the second heart attack. Dr. Callahan.
I think that's a very accurate observation. And again, I would just point out that sort of cycle, vicious cycle, is true of depression and other mental illnesses, but it's also true of many physical illnesses. The population of people that we did this study on, they were all older adults. They're all 60 years of age and older. All of them were patients at Eskenazi Health, and they came from the primary care clinics there. And most of them have multiple medical problems. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that we find in older adults is that you rarely find an older adult who just has depression or they just have diabetes. It gets even more complicated because they're rarely just on an antidepressant. They're usually on medications for their other chronic conditions as well. And then, as you've heard spoken to already this hour, many of them have social stressors, socioeconomic stressors, or maybe conflict in the family. And trying to ascribe one particular thing, you know, what was the straw that broke the camel's back, it really becomes quite impossible. And you do have then these groups of people that go through a cycle of one event right after the other.
We are talking about depression and heart disease, the link between them. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Jesse Stewart of the IUPUI School of Science, Dr. Chris Callahan, director of the IU Center for Aging Research, and Cindy Wilson of Eskenazi Midtown Community Health. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about depression and heart disease, really the links between them. My guests are Dr. Jesse Stewart, who is with the IUPUI School of Science, Dr. Chris Callahan, who's director of the IU Center for Aging Research, and Cindy Wilson with Eskenazi Midtown Community Mental Health. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Frank, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm interested if the panel could talk a little bit about how sometimes family physicians will maybe prescribe an SSRI or some other antidepressant without doing a full assessment. And I'm wondering how, you know, as we move into more of an integrative healthcare system, how physicians are changing their views regarding mental health and how they are incorporating mental health professionals into their practice so that they can work with them to do a more full assessment. And also, what can patients do or say to maybe advocate for themselves for a more integrative care rather than just getting prescribed a pill?
Thanks very much for the call and a great question, Frank.
Frank, I think if you look back at the origins of the studies that we've been talking about, a lot of their origins were reacting to this finding that it was difficult for older adults in particular to have some of their chronic conditions, including depression, but also things like dementia, urinary incontinence, have them taken up and treated by the primary care doctors. Way back when we were doing research, we were sort of wagging our finger at the primary care doctor and saying, why can't you do better? But what we found out was that this is really something that takes a village. It takes a whole team. It takes a whole healthcare system. And it's something that Eskenazi Health invested a lot in the 70s and 80s, whether it was an electronic medical record with the Regenstrief Institute or whether it's closer connections with the Community Mental Health Association like Midtown, or bringing researchers like Dr. Stewart into the primary care clinics so that they could help reorganize the system. So I think you're seeing now, again, evidence from these studies that shows primary care physicians that there are things that can be done. There are models of care that work for their older patients. In terms of the advocacy question, I think it has to be just that. One of the things that we try to teach older adults is that they need to ask questions. But for you, we say go with your mom, go with your dad, have the family go to the doctor's visit and ask questions. And you are seeing primary care practices begin to take more of a team approach to care and have an expectation that multiple family members are going to show up when dad goes to the doctor.
And also at Eskenazi, our federally qualified healthcare centers, Midtown has embedded social workers that are in each of our sites. So we are available in real time. If a physician identifies somebody during their just a regular visit that is exhibiting signs and symptoms of depression, they will call us in and we will provide an intervention and treatment in real time and then bring them back in for further counseling when that's actually indicated.
But it sounds like, you know, in some ways, if there's a theme to all of this, you know, whether you use the term integrative or holistic or whatever, that part of what needs to go on is we stop looking at these things in isolation and realize that there are correlations. Is that a fair assessment of what your study revealed, Dr. Stewart?
Yes, I would say that is a fair assessment of what our study revealed. So this integrated care idea is one theme. I think another major theme that all of us are hitting on is patients taking on an active role in the management of their conditions. And I wanted to address the previous caller really quickly. Another thing a patient can do prior to seeking treatment is learning about treatment options. And a good source for quality information is Medline Plus, for example. The internet can be overwhelming. You can get some really bad information, but Medline Plus is high quality information. You can know what your treatment options are and take on an active role in care. So integrated care and activated patients, I think, is the future.
We are talking about the connection between depression and heart disease, depression and stroke. Dash, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John, and happy spring to you and your guests.
Happy spring to you. What's on your mind, Dash?
Thank you. Well, I've been treated for depression for about 25 years, and one of the things that initially happened that I thought was curious was the substantial weight gain from the medications that I was prescribed, and I thought that joke about it that you go in and ask the doctor, you say, you know, I've been depressed, and he says, well, I'm going to give you a medicine. It's going to make you fat and impotent. Now how do you feel? And I wondered if there's a correlation between those medications and the weight gain and something that they could tie to the heart disease or just basic general health.
Thanks very much. That's a good call and question. Thanks very much, Dash.
Well, Dash, the answer is yes, there is a connection, particularly with sexual function and the newer medications. And that's been a known side effect since the medications were developed. The weight gain is kind of a mixed bag, as you've heard, even in terms of diagnosis. For some people, the problem is they lose their appetite, and the difficulty with other people is that they eat more. Some of the more complicated regimens for treatment of serious depressions include drugs that were originally developed to treat psychoses, and some of those medications have a known side effect of weight gain. What makes your question even more complicated, though, is that sometimes the sexual dysfunction and the weight gain are from the depression and not from the medication. And those can be very difficult to disentangle.
Is it, in part of that, I mean, Dash just said that he'd been in treatment for depression for 25 years. I mean, is this something that you can phase out of or, you know, to some degree, you know, a subject that's been in the news lately, is it a bit like addiction that, you know, once you have it, you have it. You're going to have to be dealing with it for the rest of your life. Cindy, I'll throw that to you.
I think the answer is that in some people's cases, that it is a chronic condition that they will have to treat their entire life. I could compare it to diabetes. Someone who's diagnosed with diabetes in their 20s are going to continue to take medication the rest of their life. There are some people who have a major depressive disorder that will continue to take medications and have treatment for that, you know, in the rest of their life. And it's really about what their quality of life is and helping them to maintain independence and be symptom free and to really be able to have that be well managed. There are some people who will have maybe episodes of depression. They have treatment for that and they really don't ever have those symptoms again. So there's a wide variety of how depression can actually appear. We talked about dysthymia earlier. That's just a different kind of depression where someone might just have a kind of a chronic mood change for, you know, several years. So it's really got a lot of different signs and symptoms that may manifest itself.
Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Yeah, I think there's some good news, too. I agree depression is a chronic condition. What's interesting, though, is with respect to relapse or recurrence of depression, what's been found is that psychotherapy, in particular cognitive behavioral therapy, cuts the risk of a depression relapse in half compared to antidepressants. So while they're both effective when you're doing them, cognitive behavioral therapy has these durable effects that lower your risk over the long term. Medications protect you only while you're on them.
We are talking about the connection between depression and heart disease here on No Limits. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm a psychiatric and mental health registered nurse in Indianapolis, and I'm also very involved in the animal community. I know that studies have shown that people who own pets or who are around them a lot have a lower rate of depression, and I'm just wanting to ask the guests, do you see a future for pet therapy, both in the psychiatric setting, but also in the regular hospital setting where you have cardiac patients? You know, can we anticipate the onset of possible depression and initiate some kind of either pet therapy or alternative therapy?
Thank you very much for the call and the question, Mary. Dr. Stewart.
I think that's a really interesting idea, and one that's particularly interesting in this conversation. So I don't know if you're aware of this research, but there's evidence that having a pet can lower your blood pressure also. So if you think about
Do we know why that is? I'm sorry to interrupt, but
It's probably – I mean, I would speculate that it's a stress reduction mechanism, so companionship, maybe distraction from what you're ruminating about, exercise possibly. I'm sure there are some other reasons. But this notion of pet therapy might be useful for targeting both depression and cardiovascular risk at the same time. So I think that's a very interesting idea.
How about the idea of are there any other factors or ways that you can intervene in this cycle before the depression occurs? Because what Mary was saying is, you know, you sort of anticipate the onset of depression and you use a pet. Are there other ways that, well, A, is it possible to anticipate the onset of depression? And B, if you can, you know, what things might alleviate it? Dr. Callahan.
Well, yes, and it might be a pet. It might be many other things. But if you think about Dr. Stewart's earlier comment about self-management, and again, we're trying to make it clear that this is true for any chronic illness, that you begin to recognize early the signs. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's more effective to intervene on your headache if you do it as soon as you're aware of a headache than if you wait 12 hours until it's raging. And the same could be true of symptoms of depression or other mental illnesses, that you are self-aware enough that you can see you're slipping into this. And what Dr. Stewart mentioned about cognitive behavioral therapy, that's part of what it's going to teach you. That's a red flag. I recognize that as a symptom I had before I slipped into this the last time. Then what got me out of it the last time? Was I jogging? Did I spend more time with my family? Was I taking the dog for more walks or interacting with people at the dog park? Those things are going to be very unique to an individual, what works for them and what doesn't. Maybe for one person it has to be a medication, but it could be many different things.
We are talking about the link between depression and heart disease here on No Limits. Dave, welcome to the program.
My question relates to long-term. I've been dealing with depression probably for the last 20, 25 years, but it comes in cycles. And I'm aware of it, but the real link for me is stress and depression. And I've got something new going on now. I'm having TIAs, and a recent testing revealed that I have had a real stroke in the past. And I'm wondering if your panel could talk about the links between stress, depression, and stroke.
Good question. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Dave. Dr. Stewart.
So with respect to the relationship that you mentioned, there is a connection between stress and stressful life events and depression, and that's very well established, and it sounds like you've recognized that in your daily life. As we've been discussing, there is also a link between depression, both depression and stress, and an increased risk of of stroke. So those connections are established.
We've gotten an email question from a regular listener named Jerry, who says, I suffered a massive coronary 3 days after my 31st birthday. I also am a cancer survivor. I suffer from gout, chronic gastritis, arthritis, sleep apnea, and various other minor chronic conditions. A comorbidity that includes depression and anxiety disorder are, not surprisingly, also part of the mix. But I am now 67 years old and am still walking around and frequently still having lots of fun. I have the most beautiful and smartest grandchildren in the world. My artwork is improving, and I hit 3 winners at better than $30 payoffs within the last couple of weeks. Life is worth living, and it's worth the trouble to follow your doctor's advice. Okay, well, I think we'll assume, since we've got medical health care professionals, that you all are in favor of having people follow the doctor's advice here. But I want to pick up on what I think is also kind of a hidden thesis here in Jerry's email. How much of this is also about trying to find some joy, find the things that do give you pleasure? Is there a therapeutic value in that? Dr. Stewart.
So that's a big part of psychotherapy for depression, would be helping someone to engage in pleasurable activities. And it's not just a part of those treatments. I think it's something that we all do to manage our mood. And it can be very effective, whether it's a hobby, interacting with your pet, whatever it might be, going out to dinner with your spouse, those sorts of things can improve mood and are part of treatments for depression.
And I should have asked this earlier, but is there a place where people can find your study or find the results, some sort of executive summary or something like that? Is it online or?
Yes. So it's published in the January issue of a journal called Psychosomatic Medicine.
Go ahead and give that to them again. I really wish people would write it. You know, ride around in their cars with pencils in hand for when I'm talking, but they don't.
So the journal is Psychosomatic Medicine. It's the January issue. And I think if you Googled Jesse Stewart and Psychosomatic Medicine, it would probably pop up.
You'll find it. So it is the first day of spring, as one of the callers mentioned here. I'd like to leave people with you know, this has been scary and kind of at times depressing in and of itself stuff. What's a concrete step you can take to avoid this cycle here? I'll start with you.
I think that you learning about the symptoms and being aware of your symptoms, being aware of what your options are, and I think it's the patient activation that we've all kind of alluded to today. You have to really take the initiative and be prepared to go out and seek the treatment.
And I'm afraid that will have to be the last word. I'm assuming you guys would say amen anyhow. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Jesse Stewart, Dr. Chris Callahan, and Cindy Wilson. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.